We're going to actually be in Deuteronomy this evening. A lot of times we do kind of go over a lot of different things and don't settle into one particular place. But this covenant that God told Moses to make with the people in Deuteronomy 29 through 30, as we said last week, has ramifications for even the new heavens and the new earth, because we're still going to be creatures, and the doctrine of the resurrection from the dead insists that we understand that part of our humanity is the physical. I can't see any reason for a resurrection from the dead if it's just going to be a resurrection of the body and that's all it is, unless the body's pretty important for our function in the kingdom that's coming. Last week we went a long way into some of the implications of those kinds of issues in regard to the body. And I did that because I wanted us to understand that this land covenant is an important part of life. We've argued over and over and over, and I don't mean argue, but I mean it was our study that God has addressed us according to the way He made us. And the first thing He did was make a body, and then He made it alive, and then we became living souls. So last week we were looking at some of the preliminary issues in God establishing a different covenant, because it says in chapter 29 verse 1, these are the words of the covenant which the Lord commanded Moses to make with the sons of Israel in the land of Moab besides the covenant which He made with them at Horeb. And the significance of that besides is the covenant that God made with the nation at Mount Sinai was the imposition of the law, and it was always intended to be temporary, long term. I mean, it was supposed to be a long term thing, but it was also always designed to be temporary, because that's the New Testament argument that once Jesus came, He fulfilled the law, and therefore He set it aside. So we're operating on a whole different basis. There is going to be a return to national Israel, and the law was the national constitution. So we don't really know exactly how much of that old covenant or constitution is going to be imposed when the nation is reestablished in the land. But according to the prophecies of Jeremiah and Ezekiel, there are going to be sacrifices reinstituted. There'll be memorial things rather than what they were at the beginning. But nonetheless, I'm not real sure just how much of the national constitution that Israel had at Mount Sinai is going to be reimposed when Jesus is actually the king of the whole world. There are going to be different nations, and Israel will be, according to some of the promises, Israel is going to be the primary, the most exalted nation, because it'll be Jesus ruling in Jerusalem from the nation of Israel, and His rule will extend over the whole earth. So when we first started out talking about the promise of eternal life, we made that handout that had the eternal life and what is required for God to provide us with life forever. And one of those things has to do with the sustaining of the physical body. And then like that handout, there was one that had the Abrahamic covenant, and then it had underneath it the land covenant, the Davidic covenant, and the new covenant. And those are parallel to the promise of eternal life and the things that are necessary for us to have real life, physically, relationally, and spiritually. So this evening we're going to look into this issue of the land, because it's a real serious thing. We find in Deuteronomy 29 and 30 some really heavy-duty curses that were imposed on the nation because they refused to be faithful to Yahweh as their God. And we've witnessed in the history of human history, especially since the first century, some of the horrible, horrible, horrible things that have happened to the Jewish people. And they're tied to the problem of not responding to God according to His Word. I'm pro-Israeli, but I also understand that when God said, those that curse you, I'll curse, and those that bless you, I will bless, he didn't mean that we were supposed to just be gung-ho for whatever Israel wants to do as a nation and that kind of thing, because they're still rejecting their Messiah. They have never come to grips with the fact that the Son of God came into their midst and they had him crucified by Rome, and they've never come around as a nation, and they're not going to until the time of Jacob's trouble. The Bible says during the tribulation period, where the judgment is heavy, heavy, heavy on the nation, that they'll come around. It says they'll see him whom they have pierced and mourn. So they're going to finally, they're going to realize that Jesus is their Messiah. So it's a sobering thing. But the main thing with the land as a covenant, the land was given to them perpetually, but their ability to live in the land was contingent on whether they would be faithful to the covenant or not. So even though the land's always been theirs by divine assignment, they have been put out of the land. They were put out. Assyria took the 10 tribes of the northern kingdom and they never came back. And then Babylon took the southern kingdom and they were out for 70 years. But even when they came back, they didn't really have the freedom that they'd had before, because they had all these other nations that were dominating them. And we're seeing some of that in the prophecies of Daniel on Sunday evening. But after Jesus came and they rejected him, God sent the Roman armies of Titus in AD 70 and just destroyed the whole city and the temple and everything. And it scattered the nation into all the nations of the world. And it was that way until 1948. And that's when God started drawing them back to the land. But even now, they're in the land in unbelief. I mean, they have some degree of camaraderie, if you want to call it that, with Christians. They appreciate the fact that Christians are basically for them as a nation. Most, well, maybe some Christians are, depending on how influenced they are by the biblical text. We've got so many variations of Christianity now in the world that it's just a puzzle. So let's go through this. It says, I want to start out with what I call the first major issue of the deceit and God's exposure of it, because the temptation in the garden was aimed at all three of the elements of man's makeup. And it started with eating. And that's a physical body issue. So when God first formed man out of the dust of the ground, he actually created a body that whenever it has a spirit in it and it's alive, and the person that is alive is a relational living soul, the body itself automatically, just because it's a body of dust, was a needy entity. We don't have the capacity to just go through life without anything different. That's why we have to eat. That's why we have these eating meetings. That's why we have to eat, because when God created us out of the dust of the ground, he created a need in man for replenishing all of the components of that dust, because that's where all the nutrients are. And when we do things in our physical bodies, our bodies are burning energy. They're using up the nutrients that come through the soil. Now, there are multiple ways that they come. I mean, you can plant seeds and grow the plants and then eat the fruit of whatever it is you planted. And a lot of times what you're eating is just the seeds again. I mean, you plant corn, you get it on the cob, you eat the seeds. Lots of plants are, well, when God originally created them, the plants are all edible. You could eat them. But the whole point was that the roots of the plants were drawing the nutrients up out of the dust of the ground and incorporating them into the body of the plant, so that when you eat the body of the plant, you nourish your own body. And that's an automatic reality that I don't think is ever going to cease to be. In Revelation 21 and 22, the fruit of the tree of life is the tree of life bears its fruit every month. And the scriptures talk about the leaves of the tree are for the health of the nations, even in the new heavens and in the earth. So we still have this reality as a physical body of needing the constant supply of whatever it takes to make us capable of doing things, energy and all of that. So the need was designed to be met by the processes that God created for our digestive systems in our bodies, and regaining the losses that we lose as we burn it up, as we do things. Our bodies have to be constantly replenished. So the promise of a land was a significant thing, because what God was doing was He was promising that He would supply them with what they needed from the dust of the ground by having a land that was made out of the dust of the ground, and then they could plant their crops, and they could eat the animals that were eating the crops, and they would still get the nutrients that came from the dust of the ground. So in the beginning, God planted a garden, and He filled it with plants that would produce what the body needed for the life to be sustained, and He put man in there, and He cautioned him about one tree. And the first element of the temptation was to generate a contradiction to God's warning that the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil was a death-producing fruit. He said, in the day you eat thereof, you will die. Literally, He said, dying you will die. But that meant that there would be a phasing in of death. And, of course, in the biblical record, it took 900 years for most of the pre-flood generations to go through the process of dying. But they all did. Genesis 5 is, and he died, and he died, and he died, and he died. Because God had said, if you eat that, it'll kill you. He didn't say it'll kill you right on the spot. And I think, myself, that that was one of the problems. The contradiction that the serpent introduced in Genesis 3 was, you will not die. It was as blatant a contradiction of what God had said would happen as it could be. And we've said many times in our, I've said many times in our interaction that there was no validation there for you won't die. Who was this serpent? What did he have? What did they have to have any confidence that he would tell them the truth? They had none. There was no way to validate his declaration that you wouldn't die except by eating. But he had created a scenario of intimidation, because they, Adam and Eve, believed that God had their best interests at heart all the time. But when the serpent said you won't, well, that's an accusation that God's a liar. Well, you can't trust a liar. You can't.
That makes me wonder, do they even have a concept of lie, you know? That there could be something that was not true.
I don't know, because I do know that when Adam and Eve were created, they were created with a certain deposit of information and knowledge already in their brains. I mean, they were functioning adults the day they were created.
Well, when they said, when he said to them, he got Eve to question him, when he said, did God really say? Did God really say? I think he said it kind of like that.
Yeah.
Did God really say that you will surely die or something? Anyway, it got her to thinking, well, I guess that got her to...
Well, that was an initial stage, but he actually came around and said, you will not die.
I know.
And so that was the beginning of the problems, because without validation, they just had to choose who they were going to believe. And the tree, the fruit, had a certain eye appeal, and it says that Eve saw the fruit, that it was good for food. And the problem was, she ate it and she was still alive. She didn't just drop dead. And I think that they probably thought that that's what you shall surely die meant. And I really believe myself that the reason Adam was drawn into that was because, in the first place, he and his wife had probably the most perfect relationship that was possible before the fall. And when he saw her eat that fruit, he knew that God had said that there was going to be a severe penalty for anybody that ate it, and he figured he was going to lose his wife. He was going to lose that relationship on all levels, physically, emotionally, and spiritually. And he saw that she didn't fall over dead. And if, you know, with a little bit of imagination, you can almost hear the serpent say, "See, I told you she wouldn't die." And so with all that he had to lose, not realizing, we don't know what Adam realized and didn't realize, but in the law of Moses, if a woman did something and her husband immediately contradicted it, she wouldn't be held accountable for it. So there's a real possibility that if Adam had stood his ground, she wouldn't have been lost to him, but he didn't. And that was the beginning of the deceit.
When they hid from God, you know, did they have fear that God was going to kill them?
This is the next issue, because it didn't produce a death immediately, except that it did, because their fleeing from him was a relational death. And so they knew that they had done wrong, and they were afraid of him when they heard him, because he had said, "You'll die," and if the fruit didn't kill him, well, then they may have figured that he was going to. But in any case, they're afraid, and that was relational death. That happened that day. The rest, the physical dying, took 900 and some years. But the relational death happened that day. And they were afraid. They ran and hid. So that was the beginning. And the issue of God's warning, the imposition of death occurred, and the divine exposure was pretty plain after the fact. And that's kind of the way I have a friend. I haven't maintained the friendship very well since the last time I saw him was probably in 97, but he said one time to me, "How come it is that we don't realize until after we've done it?" And I think he was speaking for everybody. I mean, we make thoughtless decisions, and all of a sudden we're caught on the consequences, and we think, "I knew better than that," but it's already done. So I think that was the beginning. And it had to do with the body. I believe that the body was affected. If there wasn't a genetic poison in that fruit, I'll be really surprised. I believe that the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil affected the genetic makeup that is passed on by the male to all of the generations that follow. There's something wrong with the genes, the genetic makeup, the DNA. And it's a death thing. That's why we always die. The glorified body we're going to get will be immortal, so we won't have that to deal with anymore once he comes. Maybe tonight, hopefully. But anyway. So the first aspect of God's reclamation of man had to have something to do with the body. And we noticed in Genesis 12 that God told Abram, "I want you to leave your land and go to a land that I will show you." So he was actually requiring Abram to forsake his fields and crops and all of the pasture land and everything that he used for his herds and flock. He had to leave. And he was going to go somewhere that God hadn't shown him yet. So he was just on his way. And when he got there, there was a pretty good famine in the land. So the land didn't seem like it was going to be all that good a provider or a provision. So he went to Egypt. That was a big mistake. But that's the foundation for the land covenant, because God knows that we're going to be physical creatures for all eternity. We don't know what our bodies are going to really be like. We know that there'll be some semblance to what they're like now. I mean, Jesus still had two arms and two legs and when he appeared to them. But he could also eat. And he could appear and disappear at will. He could go through walls and doors without opening any. So we really don't know what the body's going to be like. But one thing we do know, it's still going to be a creation. And as a creation, it's got to have divine supply. So that's the foundation for this whole issue of the land covenant. So The issue of believing in God's supply of a good land was eventually addressed with this specific covenant. Chapter 29. God made another covenant with the people, and it was different than the one at Sinai. And so Moses summoned all Israel, and he said to them, in verse 2, "You have seen all that the Lord did before your eyes in the land of Egypt to Pharaoh and all his servants and all his land, the great trials which your eyes have seen, those great signs and wonders. Yet to this day, the Lord has not given you a heart to know, nor eyes to see, nor ears to hear." You know, we're puzzled and a little bit perhaps condemning, and not necessarily in a bad way, but how in the world could they watch those plagues? How could they walk through the sea on dry ground and then turn around and watch the waters come back and kill all of the Egyptian soldiers? And then how did they do that and then not be faithful or believing? But within 3 days they were belly aching because they thought they didn't have a supply of water or whatever. They just didn't realize that the water was there. All Moses had to do was tap that rock and the water gushed out. And we're talking here at least 1.5 million people, maybe more, because there were 600,000 men over 20. So there was a massive crowd. And even if it was a great big rock, it'd have to gush out lots of water to feed all the flocks and herds and the people and all. I mean, it was a massive crowd. And they saw God do that. But they still didn't get it. And in God's complaint toward them throughout the wandering in the wilderness was, "What's it going to take? You've tested me all these 10 times and you still don't." So that's the point of verse 4. What are you going to say?
I was asking how your translation reads that verse.
Verse 4. It says, "Yet to this day the Lord has not given you a heart to know, nor eyes to see, nor ears to hear." Is that different from yours?
No, it's the same. But it just makes you think, well, it's God's fault. He didn't give them
right. Well, it is true that God didn't make the change for them immediately, instantaneously, like we would like. I mean, when we get a notice on the prayer chain that somebody's got some physical ailment, we pray and we want God to fix it now. Well, most of the time God just doesn't fix things that way. He fixes them over time. He uses all kinds of intermediate agencies to do it. In our case, he uses doctors and medical facilities and medicines and all those kinds of things. And it's not wrong for us to take advantage of those as long as we recognize that God's our healer. But the fact is, you remember the woman that had the issue of blood for, was it 18 years? How come she got healed and all the rest of the women that had problems didn't? And when Stephen, was it Stephen in his sermon in Acts that said, maybe it was Jesus. But anyway, the thing was, you know, during the period of the great apostasy under Elijah, He didn't send Elijah to any of the widows in Israel. Sent him to a widow that was outside the land, and she's the one that fed him, and God multiplied and multiplied and multiplied and multiplied the food that she had in her home. And he said, God didn't heal any lepers in Israel, but Naaman, when he came, Elijah was used by God to heal him. So there are many, many puzzles about this. But I don't think Moses is saying it's God's fault in verse 4. I think what he's saying is there's a process here. And the process is in its early stages. And it really is. The giving of the law on Mount Sinai was designed by God to show his people that they were incapable of being righteous in and of themselves, out of their own abilities. the Jewish nation as a nation went into apostasy because they believed that law was given in order to enable them to earn their way to heaven by behaving. But the burden of behaving was so heavy because of the carnality that's a part of us as fallen people that they couldn't do it. So they rebelled and they turned to other gods for some kind of solution. And the other gods didn't have it. But the real problem there was that they wanted God to do it now.
Well,
and he didn't.
What happened in Egypt? How they got delivered from Egypt? What happened when they were sent to spy out the promised land?
Yeah.
What happened in the 40 years of wandering?
Mm-hmm.
Israel today still does not have that heart.
No, they don't.
Because they were unable to receive it.
Well, and that's part of the process. We're actually told in this covenant that you guys are not going to obey this covenant, and God's going to pull all the curses in, of the curses upon you, and then in the last days you'll come around.
You know, one thing I think about is that, go ahead, Jim. In his time, God, the same thing with salvation and sanctification. I mean, he has the power to just pop us on the head with a stick like Moses did the rock and say, you're saved.
Yeah.
But that's not what's best for us because he loves us.
Well, and at the rapture, we're going to be instantaneously fixed. It'll be a sudden jolt, but whatever.
There's been a known fact on earth for all of my life is forced following is not true following.
That's right. It's not out of love.
And I'm surprised today because I never hear any of those leaders in Israel say anything about that land. God gave us this land and we're going to keep it. If anybody tries to stop them, we're going to kick their butt.
And they will.
There's no reference to the historical presentation of that land to them.
Well, not in the political speeches that are made out there. There is a, well, there's a group of Jews that are what they call traditional Jews, and they believe that stuff, and they believe the land belongs to them. And they're...
When you look at what God has done for Israel, even after they become a nation, 7-day war, where they were attacked on three sides and they went from the 7 days.
Yeah.
You know, they thought that was their right. Little did they know that God was on their side.
Well, their enemies are starting to realize it. Somebody asked some of the Palestinians that were firing those missiles over into Israel why their missiles didn't do more damage. He said their God won't let them. So the enemies are beginning to realize it, but whether the Jews do or not. I mean, they're going to come around sooner or later, but it'll be later.
And there are some...
Oh, well, there are Messianic Jews. There are people that are... Yeah, I mean, God's still saving individuals, and some of them come from Israeli stock, and some of them come from German stock, and some of them come from Chinese stock. And I mean, he's saving people all of every kindred, nation, tongue, and tribe now. But as a nation, this covenant was put in place, in a sense, I don't know how to say this. In a sense, if you're going to be used by God, you're going to suffer a lot. Jesus was the perfect servant of God, and he was severely abused. And Jesus himself taught his disciples, if you don't deny yourself and take up your cross and follow me, you can't be my disciple. And he says, through much tribulation, we must enter into the kingdom. What he's saying is, if you're going to be a champion of truth in this fallen world, you're going to pay a price. And there are a lot of people who say, well, if that's the case, I don't want to be a Christian. But they don't realize what they're sacrificing. They're sacrificing eternity for a little blip of time.
Yeah, that's another thing, too. I know I'm guilty of, God has a plan, and I mean, it's
huge.
It's way too huge for me to even begin to understand his plan. And, you know, we zero in on these certain areas, and there's no way we can understand them.
That's why Paul, after writing 11 chapters in the book of Romans, ended chapter 11 by saying, how unsearchable are his judgments and his ways past finding out. Mm-hmm. I mean, how can you explain God saving the thief on the cross? That was a foxhole conversion. It was real. But, you know, in our minds, I was saved when I was 17 years old. How come I didn't have to wait until I was 30 or hanging on the cross or in the, you know, in the prison or whatever? There's no explaining. These things are beyond us. We just have to live a day at a time. But the thing is, in this covenant, he says, to this day, the Lord hasn't given you a heart to know or eyes to see or ears to hear. And he's not, he's just recording the fact. This is your condition. You still don't get it. And he isn't promising them that they're going to get it either. Because notice what he says in verse 5 and following. I led you for 40 years in the wilderness. Your clothes have not worn out on you. Your sandal hasn't worn out on your foot. You've not eaten bread, nor have you drunk wine or strong drink in order that you might know that I am Yahweh your Elohim. When you reached this place, Sihon the king of Heshbon and Og the king of Bashan came out to meet us for battle, but we defeated them. And we took their land and gave it as an inheritance to the Reubenites and the Gadites and the half-tribe of the Manassites. So keep the words of this covenant to do them, that you may prosper in all that you do. Well, the exhortation's there, the responsibility is there, but the capacity's not. Okay?
Well, we've
got to
realize that
in
God's big plan,
there's
a little plan for me.
That's exactly right. The way I explain it for in the kingdom that is coming, the eternal kingdom. According to the last two chapters of the book of Revelation, it's going to be a kingdom of enormous economic activity. The kings of the earth are going to accumulate glory, and they're going to bring parts of it into the New Jerusalem as acts of worship to God. But that all that means is we're going to be busy. Every one of us. And as a consequence, every one of us are in God's plan to be plugged in somewhere in the kingdom. And it's not too much different than the way it is now. I mean, when God created me, he gave me certain innate capacities, abilities. And my life has kind of fallen along in the natural thing, has fallen along that path. And then when he saved me, he gave me spiritual gifts or two or three. And my spiritual development has worked along those paths. But that's his plan for me. It's not his plan for everybody. And so when we look at the big picture, just like Lewis said, there's a little plan for each one of us to fit into the big plan. But it's so massive that it just blows our minds. Ever since I learned that word quark, my illustration has been, if he can control all the quarks, he can certainly handle my problems.
We're too used to microwave ovens and
instant
feeds and stuff like that to even comprehend. If someone were to tell you that and you have a little knowledge of God, you would say, this man is crazy.
Yes.
It's like the Buddha told Paul, you're mad.
Yeah. Yes.
Can you define the quark again?
It's the smallest known particle of matter known to man. It's smaller than an atom. It's smaller than the nucleus of an atom. It's smaller. It's so small that the scientists in their great wisdom say it may not even have any matter. It may not even be really matter. But it has to be matter. Cause and effect.
It makes up the things that they're seeing.
It's cause and effect. We know a lot of stuff that we know below our visual capacities or above them simply because of the side effects. I mean, they know, for example, when they're looking through their telescope, they may not see this a star or whatever, but they see the light bend and they know that there's gravity pulling it. Well, that's cause and effect. And that's why no man ever has an excuse before God, because everything in this world's cause and effect. All you got to do is observe. And Romans 1 says God's creation shows that he's there, that he's personal, and he's powerful. Everybody knows that, but not everybody yields to it. All right.